Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio is now in open session. Pursuant to adjournment, you may proceed.
Good morning to all of you. First case for this morning, Brookwood Presbyterian Church versus the Ohio Department of Education. Mr. Grubbs?
Mr. Chief Justice, I would like to reserve at least 2 minutes of my time for rebuttal. Mr. Chief Justice Brown, Justices, may it please the Court. In revised code section 3314.015 subsection D, the General Assembly, using words that only a lawyer could find ambiguous, said the following. The decision of the Department of Education to disapprove an entity for sponsorship of a community school may be appealed by the entity in accordance with section 119.12 of the revised code. My client, Brookwood Presbyterian Church, is a qualified tax-exempt entity under 501c3 of the Internal Revenue Code. They applied for sponsorship of community schools with the Department of Education, but the Department of Education decided to disapprove my client's application. My client timely appealed that decision, but the lower courts in this case dismissed their appeal for lack of subject matter jurisdiction. We are here today seeking reversal and reinstatement of Brookwood's administrative appeal for further proceedings. The denial of a community school's application to be a sponsor is appealable in accordance with 119.12 because the General Assembly says it is in 3314.015 subsection D. First, resort to the definitions or the specific words of qualification for appeal that are contained in 119.12 are unnecessary here. The qualifications of there must be an adjudicative order. What is required is a final order. We have a final order. It's appealable under 119.12, not necessarily because it's an adjudication order, I submit that it is, but because the legislature in a more specific statute says that it's appealable.
You're talking about the appealability of the order.
Yes.
But if I'm understanding it correctly, it was disallowed because Brookwood is not an education-oriented institution or entity.
Correct, Your Honor. That was the ground stated.
And isn't that the core issue that we should be focusing on as opposed to the provisions of 119, which suggests that the order can be appealed, and assuming for the moment that we agree with that aspect, isn't the core question the definition of what kind of an entity Brookwood is?
The core substantive question, yes, Your Honor, that is the core substantive question. That is whether or not my client is education-oriented and therefore meets one of the six different factors that the department must consider in granting an application. That is the key substantive question. Procedural question, however, is we've never gotten to argue the substance yet because the courts below have dismissed our case for lack of subject matter jurisdiction. And they did so because of this clear language, but they said that there was another subsection of 0.015 that trumped the clear appealable grant given in subsection D, and that was subsection B3, which says essentially that the determination by the Department of Education as to whether an entity is education-oriented is final. The lower courts, well, the Court of Appeals, seized upon that statute, subsection, and said the General Assembly has told us that this is a final determination, and therefore you don't get an appeal, notwithstanding that the only part of this statute that deals with jurisdiction for appeal is subsection D. Subsection D says you can appeal this determination.
Well, procedurally, you're already up here. I mean, you've done very well on the procedural route. You got to the top. Not bad.
So far, so good. Thank you.
But what I'm having difficulty with is the determination that that we allow educational entities, and you're not one of those. And maybe I'm not asking the question the right way, but I'd like you to address that for me. That's my problem with it.
Certainly, if I understand correctly, on that substantive question, the specific words of the statute is whether or not my client, among other things, is education-oriented. Now, the department here seized upon two things. One, general, which we feel is an unconstitutional discriminatory determination not found in the statute, which says we're a church, and churches cannot be education-oriented. We take issue with that and are prepared today or at another time to fully demonstrate that the Presbyterian Church, not only of USA, but also my specific client, the Brookwood Presbyterian Church, has been involved extensively in education, and not parochial, but generalized education in their community. That's a major tenet of Presbyterianism since the beginning of John Calvin, and it's carried through. Princeton University was founded, et cetera. So,
is there a Presbyterian Board of Education, or is it a church-directed school? And maybe I'm not asking that the right way, but other denominations would have a school board, and I'm wondering whether or not Brookwood or the Presbyterian Church globally has a school board, or whether this is a church-operated facility.
And let me clarify again, we are seeking to be a sponsor of community schools. My client is not seeking to be a community school, because there is a specific statute that says that a religious organization may not run a community school under Chapter 3314. The community schools structure are governed in a three-tiered scenario. The State Board of Education will approve various sponsors of community schools, which are public schools. Those sponsors then, pursuant to rules and regulations, will then seek out and oversee individual schools. The sponsor is not involved in direct education. They are involved in oversight of the individual community schools. So this is not a situation where a religious entity will be directly involved in the education of the students. This is an instance where the religious body, the nonprofit entity, the tax-exempt entity, like other tax-exempt entities which have been granted sponsor status, will be overseeing other schools.
Council, isn't that the nub of the problem here, is that this is a two-step or two-part or process? First, you have to be determined to be an eligible sponsor before you can apply to actually sponsor a school. So you have to be determined eligible first. Never got to the second step, correct, because the State Department said that you were not an eligible sponsor. And that's the part that says that decision is final, meaning it's not appealable. You may be able to get in a different way, but not appealable. And so you never get to the second part, that they turned down your application to be a sponsor because they only decided that you weren't eligible to even apply to be a sponsor.
Okay.
Now, could you respond to that?
Absolutely, absolutely, because that is the core confusion that has been interjected by the Department of Education here. If we could for a moment, just for clarity, none of these steps involve my client becoming a community school. I think we've got that out of the way. We're talking about my client like other nonprofits, simply overseeing as a sponsor. In order to be approved as a sponsor, there's one step. There's one application only. Once a sponsor is approved, then there'll be individual contracts that they enter into with the various schools. The step that we're talking about here is not a two-step process. It is a one-step process. The state, the Department of Education has said, well, there's eligibility requirements under 3314.02C1F that specifically deal with that. And if you have that statute in front of you, that specific statute has four noted subparts, actually six subparts, of which one is, in order to be approved, the entity must be education-oriented. There's, however, nothing in the statute that says that the department first must determine whether this applicant is education-oriented, and if so, then we're going to go look at the other factors. No, the statute says And in order to be approved as a sponsor, you have to meet all six. There's no two-step, three-step, four-step. There's one decision that the department needs to make in order to approve an entity as a sponsor.
To determine that you're eligible to be a sponsor before they actually consider an application to sponsor.
No, and that's what we specifically take issue with, because there is nothing in the statute that says that. The word eligible is not included in the statute at all. The General Assembly did not say that only eligible applicants can apply to become a sponsor.
Mr. Grubbs, it sounds to me like you're talking about D, which says if there's a decision to disprove someone for sponsorship.
Yes.
And that's where you get your appeal under the section.
Correct.
D. My question is, what are you asking of this court? It's a bit confusing because there are procedural issues, and then you get into the substance of whether you're eligible or not. Are you requesting that we reverse and remand to the Common Pleas Court so that the court may then allow you to address the issue of whether you're eligible?
Well, we believe that this court has the authority to rule on the entire matter. That is, that the action taken by the Department of Education to deny our client on the grounds of it being a religious entity is not in accordance with the statutes and unconstitutional. However, we've never been able to make a record. And so in order to, if the court deems that it wants to have a record, then we would ask that this case be sent back to the Court of Common Pleas for further proceedings under 119.12. Mm-hmm. Now, we've also asked, however, at that very beginning stage, we are confident we have a 119 appeal. And what the state did was not submit a record at all. However, there is a record. We submitted an application. We submitted supporting documents. They asked for questions. We gave them more information. There is a record. There was not a formal hearing, but there is a record. Mm-hmm. The state said, well, there was no record, and they submitted nothing to the Court of Common Pleas. And this court in Matush years ago said, and the statute says, 119.12, that if the department, the agency, fails to submit the record, well, then the applicant must be awarded judgment on the merits for their application, because the standard of review by a Court of Common Pleas is whether the order is supported by reliable and probative evidence and whether it's in accordance with law. Without a record, this court has long said, the court cannot affirm what's going on. So that's the nub of it. We're asking, if not for judgment today or judgment in this court, that if the court desires a record, it has to go back to the Court of Common Pleas so that
Well,
that
and the Court of Common Pleas had dismissed on grounds that it lacks subject matter jurisdiction. So the Court of Common Pleas never addressed any of this issue, right?
None of the substantive issues. That's correct.
Did you get a determination, Mr. Grubbs, by the Department of Education that Brookwood is not an education-oriented institution? Has that been determined at any level by the department?
So that's the ground that the department gave for disapproving my client's application. They said—
Submitted the application, yes. And you have a document from the department that says you failed to conform to the third requirement. You keep talking about the six requirements, one of which is that the department must determine that the entity is an education-oriented institution under B3. You have a determination that you're not.
That's correct, and that's what we wanted to appeal, because it's not in accordance with law.
And you're seeking the opportunity to have a Common Pleas Court review whether or not Brookwood is or is not an entity, an education-oriented entity.
Yes, and thank you.
Under subsection 3. And you want someone to review the determination of the Department of Education on that.
Correct. And that really gets to the nub of the procedural question, which is this. There is this section, B3, which says the determination of the agency is final.
Yes.
And it's right next to this thing.
That was my next question.
Get an appeal. And here's how, you know, Justice Learned Hand said that words are chameleons that reflect the color of their environment. Final, this court has said the word final in some circumstances means no appeal, okay? But in this circumstance, where you have a direct grant of appeal in subsection D, the word final goes to the standard of review that the court applies on appeal.
So we need to determine what the definition of the word final is used in that section, and then compare that to the 119 provision that authorizes an appeal from adverse determinations.
Yeah, actually, if the court determines that we are correct and that what this entire statute means, reading it entirely, both sections together, it means this. There's one determination, and the Department of Education, if they said you're not education-oriented and they said that you haven't got a record of educational progress, which is another of those factors, only one of those, as the legislature says, is, quote, final. The other one's not. If they had decided that, well, there was another factor, we'd have an appeal. We would be able to attack that. It's one decision. If they had linked both of those together, what it means is that we have an appeal. The standard of review on a 119.12 appeal is those two-part factor. A factual determination, is it supported by reliable probative evidence? And a legal determination, is it in accordance with law?
Right.
On this issue, because the legislature said the factual determination that it's final, that they're education-oriented is final, that takes away that first standard of review. The Court of Common Pleas now, under 119.12 standard review, will simply be able to say, they won't be able to second guess the agency and their area of expertise, which is what's educational. They will, however, be able to make sure that their decision was in accordance with law, that it was done pursuant to criteria adopted by rule, and it didn't violate the Constitution. That's where we still say we've got an appeal, and that's what we need to be able to bring to the forefront here.
Thank you.
I see my time has expired, Your Honor. Thank you.
Ms. Long?
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, I'm Elizabeth Long on behalf of the Department of Education. This case turns on a straightforward matter of subject matter jurisdiction. Revised Code 3314.015B3 clearly states that the Department's determination of an entity's educational orientation is final. This determination is therefore not appealable and the trial court properly dismissed for lack of subject matter jurisdiction. This is not to say that Brookwood is without a remedy, however. Brookwood can seek relief in mandamus, and in fact has already filed an action with this court that has stayed pending resolution of this predicate jurisdictional matter.
Counsel, when you look at D, though, mm-hmm. D specifically says that the decision to disprove the entity for sponsorship, it may be appealed pursuant to 119. So do we have a conflict here between the two portions of the statute or not?
Your Honor, there is no conflict between the two portions of the statute. D speaks to the department's final decision to approve or deny an application for sponsorship. That decision is appealable. However, Section B3 of the same provision speaks to the department's determination of one of the four initial conditions that an applicant must meet to be able to apply to sponsor.
So do you see this as a sequential determination by the department?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe that the four criteria specified in Revised Code 3314.02F(c)(1)(f) are threshold determinations that the department makes, and this is explained on their website to applicants as well. They screen applications to make sure that the applying entity meets these four conditions before they get to the merits of an application.
But does the statute itself make that determination that it is going to be first the eligibility requirement and then later on the application process?
The statute does not say two steps or first eligibility then later. What it says is that these conditions must be satisfied to apply.
And it says if we deny your sponsorship, you have the right to appeal in D.
Yes, but Your Honor, here the department did not disapprove an application for sponsorship. It held that this entity wasn't even eligible to apply.
And that's not denial of sponsorship in your view?
No, Your Honor, it's not. I would submit this is analogous to various other administrative determinations that are held recognized as final and within the complete discretion of an agency by this court. For example, the State Employee Relations Board has complete discretion and it is not appealable when it makes a determination of probable cause to support an unfair labor practice charge. No one can appeal that. However, if CERB goes ahead and proceeds with an unfair labor practice charge, its ultimate resolution of that claim is appealable.
Counsel,
this is a similar two-step.
Could you help me understand what a community school is?
A community school, Justice Pfeiffer, is a public school that is separate from any school district. So it is a state school, but it has been authorized by the Department of Education. It has a sponsor that oversees it and makes sure that it's complying with state regulations. The sponsor is approved by the state. The sponsor then enters a contract with the governing authority of this separate
entity. So what would be an example of sponsors that have been approved?
Examples of sponsors that have been approved include organizations that very clearly do have an organizational purpose: Richland Academy, the Thomas B. Ford Foundation, one church affiliate that was established as a separate 501c3 specifically.
Would
to
White
serve
Hat
educational
Management
purpose.
Be one of those?
I'm sorry.
Would White Hat Management, Dave Brennan's operation, would that be a community school?
Your Honor, I believe that is a community school, but I don't believe that's a 501c3 entity that was approved as a sponsor, unless I'm in Agar. I have the list of approved sponsors here, but I don't know about the specific schools and which.
You've never heard of White Hat?
I have heard of White Hat, but I don't have familiarity with how they're operated.
Well, it's a pretty big operation. Wasn't it the pioneer of all of this, the community schools? These are also called charter schools, aren't they?
Yes, the common term is charter schools.
All right. And so anyone who forms a 501c3 or what else do you have to do? How else can you get qualified? I'm having a hard time understanding why the Presbyterian Church can't make it, but all of these other folks can.
Well, Justice Pfeiffer, the Presbyterian Church is the only church that has been deemed not educationally oriented. And the Department of Education recognizes that if a church establishes a separate 501c3 whose purpose is education, that can be approved as a sponsor. It's just that the Presbyterian Church here could not show evidence of educational orientation because it submitted a letter with its application saying this church is exclusively organized and operated for religious purposes. And the department's evaluation of educational orientation is to look to whether an entity is primarily focused on education. It looks to whether it's oriented toward education.
Church has in its charter that it's operated for religious purposes, and it runs a 1-12K school. You would deny that church then, based on that charter?
The church would not be able to sponsor a community school
even though the church itself runs a private school.
Yes,
that would not qualify as a religious or education-oriented school.
Yes, but again, I want to step back here because the real question here is not the merits of Brookwood's constitutional arguments. It's whether this is the appropriate forum for deciding that.
You cite four things you have to do to be a sponsor. They cited six.
Your Honor, it's four conditions to be able to apply. And
any of the conditions besides the one we're discussing have the language that it's final?
No. However, the other three conditions are much more take it or leave it conditions. The first is that the entity has been in operation 5 years. The second is that it has assets of at least $500,000. And the third is educational orientation. And the fourth is that the entity is not a community school
itself. So if your staff person found that it didn't have assets of $500,000, they can appeal that.
Your Honor, my position would be that that is still not a final decision to deny the application. Again, that would be a threshold determination of eligibility to apply. And I don't believe that would be appealable. I think
that there's
Brookwood would have to seek relief in mandamus.
Well, what would
language in that clause that says that's final?
It does not have that language. And I could understand if the court chose to interpret the educational orientation condition differently than the other three. But as a threshold matter, and because there's really not discretion involved, it would be the department's determination of whether there's $500,000 in assets or not would turn on the materials submitted by the applicant, and I think it would be adequate to seek relief from mandamus.
Are you suggesting that if Brookwood Presbyterian would submit a separate 501c3 not-for-profit board of education, that entity could get approved, but the church can't get approved? Is that what you're telling us?
Yes, Your Honor.
Well, how
is there
could
a
they?
Definition in the statute of an education-oriented entity?
There isn't a definition per se, but the regulations and the conditions in the statute hold that say that the department will look to educational orientation generally. It looks to whether it has a successful history of implementing educational programs, and it's looking for non it's looking for secular educational programs there, and that it has a mission or operations designed to foster education.
And it's your view that there is no review of that determination by any entity or any court?
Not at all, Your Honor. I believe that this court could review that determination in mandamus. My contention is just that 119.12 does not allow for appeal here because section revised code 3314.015b3 says that the department's determination of educational orientation is final.
And your point is the final means non-appealable.
Yes, Your Honor.
That's your strongest argument?
Yes, although if you don't find that the language final is determinative, and I would submit that it is because this court hears in mandamus actions contesting various agency determinations that are said to be final, even when the statute does not say and not appealable. Even if it were not, this is not the kind of proceeding, an appeal from the kind of proceeding contemplated by the constitutional authorization of administrative appeals. This court has said that the Constitution contemplated appeals from quasi-judicial proceedings, which has been defined by this court to involve the exercise of discretion, notice, a hearing, and an opportunity to present evidence. This was not a quasi-judicial proceeding. There was no hearing here. Brookwood doesn't argue that there should have been a hearing here. The statutes don't require one. This is not that kind of quasi-judicial.
Counsel, what would be appealable under 119?
Under 119, what would be appealable is the department's decision to deny an applicant on the merits of its application. After that application has been processed by the department, scored on a rubric, evaluated on its merits, and that all occurs after these four conditions are determined.
So if you refuse to do that, it's not appealable.
I suppose if it refused to do that, yes, but it would have to be finding that the applicant doesn't meet one of these, this threshold condition of educational orientation.
It seems to me if you said the only way you can appeal is if we go through everything, and if you say we're not going through it, there's no appeal.
But, Your Honor, if the department abused its discretion by failing to consider an application, relief could be sought in mandamus, as it can here. I mean, the department's threshold determination of educational eligibility is not unreviewable.
I want to go back to the 501(c). You said, if they did that, then they could go forward. Well, they really couldn't, because you said another requirement is that you be in business for 5 years.
Yes, they would have to wait, Your Honor.
And what do they do for those 5 years with their 501(c) to make it qualify?
They have to wait, and they have
to. Do they just have to be in existence, or do they have to be operating a school for 5 years?
They don't have to be operating a school
for 5 years.
They just
have to be in existence for 5 years pursuant to the administrative code here. They have to be. The entity has been in operation for at least 5 years prior to the application. What's it mean to be in operation? Existing?
Yes, Your Honor, that's my understanding, that it's been approved as a 501(c)(3).
So it's been a 501(c)(3), and they haven't done anything except obtain assets in at least $500,000. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so they have to be, and they have, the 501(c)(3), the assets have to be titled in the 501(c)(3), is
yes.
That correct? Okay. And then the department has determined that the entity is an education-oriented entity. In other words, the application for the 501(c)(3) has to say, we're in business to educate.
Your Honor, I don't know if the 501(c)(3) application itself has to say that. Here it said it was exclusively religious and thus was not educational.
But it says the entity whose mission or operations demonstrate that it fosters education. Well, if all they have to do is exist, and they've got no operation, in other words, they're not functioning as a school or a learning institution, then they'd have to have some kind of mission statement saying that we're a 501(c)(3), we're going to call ourselves, something school,
mm-hmm.
And our mission, provided we get approved by the Department of Education, is going to be to educate.
Yes, Your Honor. All I meant was that the 501(c)(3) letter from the IRS doesn't need to specifically say this is educational oriented, but their materials and their mission statement and their application.
Does the approval by the IRS ever designate what the mission or what the existence of the 501 is for?
The approval letter that they submitted in this instance.
That was for the Presbyterian Church.
And its subordinate units, which includes Brookwood, and that is the evidence Brookwood submitted of its own 501c3
status. I don't think there's any dispute that they didn't create a separate 501c3. But I'm saying, does the IRS, when they do give an acknowledgement that this entity has met the 501c3 standards pursuant to the IRS rules, regs, and code, does that classify or identify or state what the state of Ohio is looking for to meet this criterion?
Your Honor, I don't think there's any requirement that the IRS has to designate it as such. This letter did designate it as a religious entity, not an educational one. But I don't believe there's a legal requirement that the IRS choose a category or note multiple categories.
Okay, and then the other section D of the Reg 6D says the department has determined that the entity has successfully implemented educational programs. What's that mean?
Well, the department looks to testimonial evidence and data submitted by the organization itself, may ask for additional information, as it did here from Brookwood, and determines whether they believe they have shown a history of successfully starting educational programs.
Well, but you just said that all they have to do is be in existence for 5 years, not necessarily teaching for 5 years, and yet Section D says they have to determine that they've successfully implemented educational programs. Would that mean just developing a curriculum?
I believe that it's within the department's discretion to determine that. I don't think it would have to be for 5 years, although what the department would view as sufficient would vary on the facts.
I mean, isn't it a little unrealistic to expect that a 501c3 is going to start up a school and hope that their efforts in starting that school, and it would be, I don't know what it would be classified, what type of school, but that the Department of Education is going to look upon that startup as a school as being a determination of the eligibility for the designation of community or charter school? It seems to me that you're asking them to set up a school before they can be designated as a charter school. And what do they do with their school if they're not eligible to be a charter school?
Well, I see that I'm out of time, but if I may answer the question. First of all, they're asking to be designated as a sponsor here, not a charter school itself. This
right.
would be an organization that monitors a community school. And second, I don't think you have to set up a school to have educational programs or a demonstrated commitment to education. I think there could be outreach programs or some programs that don't amount to a full school curriculum.
Counsel, that,
apologizing being unclear.
That raises a related question. I know your time is out, but I think I would, if you could answer that. In the briefs, the issue was raised that the department has never adopted criteria for education-oriented entity, or what is education-oriented entity. And I notice that it has some very general things here. Has the department specifically adopted criteria defining what an education-oriented institution or entity is?
Justice Kupp, the department's regulation on this matter is 3301-102-02. And it does reiterate portions of the revised code. It also adds in that the department must consider the mission or operations and whether they demonstrate that the entity fosters education. There are not more specific criteria, but even if Brookwood is right that the department should have adopted more specific criteria or should do so here, that doesn't amount to a constitutional violation. And again, we're here on the predicate jurisdictional question and shouldn't even be reaching those constitutional questions. If the court does believe that there's jurisdiction here, it should remand for consideration of those issues in the lower courts for the first time. But we would hold that there's no jurisdiction for this appeal, and Brookwood should proceed in mandamus.
The limited criteria that's been adopted refers to educational programs, but it doesn't refer to secular educational programs, does it?
It does not specify that.
The department is applying a religious, a secular screen, even though it's not adopted that as a criteria?
Yes, it is looking for secular programs.
Okay.
Counsel, do you know, if you do know, how many churches have actually been eligible as sponsors for these types of schools?
As 501c3 entities, there have been 24 applications, seven of which have been approved. One of those is a church affiliate, but no churches have been approved.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Long. Mr. Grubbs, you may have up to 2 minutes.
Let me start with 501c3 and how it relates to this case. The statute, the Ohio statute, says that any qualified tax-exempt entity under 501c3. There are, of course, religious, educational, scientific, charitable organizations. It's a 501c3. It's tax-qualified. That's the purpose of this statute. The fact that the IRS says that they're exclusively organized for religious purposes has to do with categories within taxation. Do they have to file regular 990s, various other things? It's a tax distinction. It's not a distinction in terms of education-oriented, as the history of the Presbyterian Church and their relationship to both secondary university education would evidence. We did submit evidence specific to our own church as well. Our church has been educating, and up until last week when school was out, has educated for the last 8 years special needs, special education students in the east side of Columbus, students who are not being served in the public schools, but who come to this church school. It's not a church school, but the school that's in the church. They have been educating those special education students, 35 this year, up to 50 in prior years,
is
for
that
over
just,
8 years.
Is that just being held in your church building, or is the church itself financially and administratively involved in it?
Well, the church, in this instance, the church serves technically as a management type, not a management company, but as a service provider. White Hat is a service provider, not a sponsor. And this, they've been providing this service of educating the students, and they have invested their own money in that.
So Brookwood hires the teachers and that sort of thing?
Correct. And then some of the payment does come through the public schools to them to pay for that service. And they've been providing that education program for more than 5 years. They qualify as an education-oriented institution on their own, even if they weren't connected with the greater Presbyterian
Church. So a service provider is someone who provides the teachers, is that what you're saying? They're staffing.
Yes, they can provide teachers, administrative assistants, janitors.
Staffing.
Yes.
Okay, but they're not the school, and they're not the sponsors. They're just a service provider that is contracted with the 501c3.
No, I'm sorry to confuse you. Brookwood, of course, is a 501c3 by virtue. They have provided this service.
Who's they?
The Brookwood Presbyterian Church has provided educational service, has hired teachers for three charter schools, I believe, in the last 8 years. So the charter schools who don't have, so now what we're talking about is a sponsor has approved a charter school, and this charter school is providing education under 3314. The charter school, in these instances, don't have the facility or the staff to handle the special education students.
So they come to your church and use your church facilities to do what they've been approved to do.
Correct. And so we provide that educational component for...
Because you're contracted, your physical plant is being contracted by the other charter schools to be a satellite location, let's say.
Yes.
Okay, so you're then a service provider?
Today, we are a service provider. The mission that we hope to have adopted by becoming a sponsor is that we can, that Brookwood can, as a sponsor, seek out and develop individual schools whose mission, the entire school whose mission is to make sure that they serve special education needs. Not all charter schools have that ability or mission, quite frankly. And that's what this church, this entity, this tax-exempt entity wants to fill that niche of providing the special education that the state requires
apart from the mission, Mr. Grubbs, the legal issue here is the definition of the education-oriented entity. My question to you is, if I heard Ms. Long correctly, she said you may proceed in mandamus. Why is it that you must succeed here, and why the mandamus isn't the appropriate remedy to get the relief you're seeking? Could you address that for me?
Yes, happily, Your Honor. At the end of the day, in terms of the review that will be provided. Mandamus will get us to the same place, but here's the rub. The standard of review in mandamus is virtually identical to what we think the standard of review under this statute is, which is, on mandamus, a court does not second-guess the factual determinations. They can't second-guess discretion of an agency. They only determine whether there was an abuse of discretion and whether that decision is in accordance with law. That's precisely what this statutory scheme provides for the appeal. And here's why it's so important that we not be shuffled back and forth through mandamus versus appeal. We have an appeal. There are these various factors, okay? One decision, but with many factors.
Well, 119 gives you the appeal. We understand that.
Yeah.
But the best argument stated by the department is it's a final order and you can't appeal from it. So seek mandamus and get your relief there. Why isn't that appropriate as a conceptual statement from the General Assembly telling everyone how to proceed in these cases?
Because, A, the General Assembly didn't say that, and what it said was this. You've got to meet these four factors.
Yeah, let's just use four,
okay? Only one of them says it's a final determination, factual. The others don't. If we do what the state is saying, there's a risk of multiplicity of suits. Maybe not in our case, because all they said was, you're not education-oriented. But in other cases, if the department were to say, well, you're not education-oriented, and you not only don't have assets of $500,000, but you don't have a demonstrated record of financial responsibility, which is really that entire statutory condition.
That's not the issue here.
Though. Well, it's not the issue here.
The only one here is the one that says their decision is final. It's not the ones that doesn't say it's final. And I understand it's a little complicated to figure out which one of these actions you need to pursue so you don't get thrown out and don't get a chance to offer the merits. So you proceed on both fronts, and so right. you're hopeful that at least one of those you'll get a hearing.
Right. But the risk, and why it's so important that we're in front of the Supreme Court, is this. If this court were to say that under this particular statutory scheme, that when the department says you're not education-oriented, you've got an action in mandamus, what about the next case? When the department has said, not only are you not education-oriented, but you don't have this demonstrated record of financial responsibility. Now they've got to do two things. Now they've got to do the 119 appeal under that financial part, and then they got to go through mandamus on the second part. The legislature didn't say to do that. There's one jurisdictional provision, and that is you get a 119 appeal. Mm-hmm. And the standard of review changes depending on whether it's an education-oriented decision or whether it's one of the others, where the court could second guess or at least examine the facts of whether it's financially responsible.
I think we got it.
Thank you, Mr. Krebs.
Thank you, Your Honor.